being redirected. We are living in an artificially induced state of consciousness that resembles sleep.
Precognitive
dissonance.
Flashing on those pictures of druids at the Stonehenge. Please, somebody.
Druids at Stonehenge. That's a 19th century fabrication, Miles.
The pictures aren't. I've seen them. This is going to be the second installment with our good friend Nick Redfern, who's going to be making regular appearances here on Precognitive Dissonance. Talking about the latest in anomaly news. Nick Redfern, of course, being an established author who's written a number of books ranging the gamut of anomaly, cryptozoology, strange phenomena.
One of which we're going to be talking about in depth tonight, Body Snatchers in the Desert. And his other works include The FBI Files, The FBI's UFO Top Secrets Exposed, A Covert Agenda, The British Government's UFO Top Secrets Exposed. And the most recent one is a Hollywood expose,
Celebrity Secrets, which
I was delighted to see included a chapter on Rowan and Martin. Not people that I would have really associated with secrets, but there you are.
Well, we're going to be featuring Nick's roundup in just a moment, and we're going to do the special two-hour show that was planned a month ago, but due to the strangenesses of everyday life, prevented our co-host from making it in and helping us complete that first appearance of Nick on the show with the in-depth discussion of Body Snatchers in the Desert. So
spontaneous water heater combustion, friends. It happens.
Oh, yeah. That is, in fact, one of the everyday life things that kept you away from us. Actually, that night it was a
car crash.
Car crash.
Judy's fine. The house is fine. The cat is fine.
Good.
But it's a damn nuisance, I'll tell you.
So you brought up to me, today is an anniversary. We've got the 60th anniversary of the Roswell incident coming up, and of course Nick's going to be talking about what he's going to be presenting there, which of course is central to the Body Snatchers in the Desert theme.
And proving once again that we live up to our name here at Precognitive Dissonance. I noticed earlier today on The Anomalist, today or yesterday, an article on the Maury Island UFO incident, which I remembered vaguely, a very complete article on the Beachcomber, www.vashonbeachcomber.com, that tied some things together. I had heard about a B-25 crash involving two Army Air Force officers, and I have heard about the Maury Island UFO, but had never realized the two incidences were so intimately connected, or that indeed the case was as dramatic as I rediscovered today.
Yeah, the Maury Island UFO case, for those that aren't aware, is pretty strange. It's June 1947, 60 years ago today. This object was sighted by multiple witnesses, and some strange radioactive sludge it was ejected from the object and injured or killed one of the
pieces of sheet metal and slag were dropped on a fishing boat. The owner of the boat recovered a number of pieces of it. Tacoma seaman Harold Dahl
DAHL, was trolling the waters just east of Maury Island looking for loose logs, which he collected and sold for profit.
And, quote, as I looked up from the wheel on my boat, I noticed six very large donut-shaped aircraft, Dahl later told one of the investigators of the incident. Quote, I would judge they were about 2,000 feet above the water and almost directly overhead. So, this story has a lot of really strange tentacles, as it were. One of the folks that's recently or been researching this subject for the last couple of decades is parapolitical investigator Ken Thomas, who has pointed up the strange connections between this case and the JFK assassination investigation. Dahl told his supervisor Fred Crisman about his UFO sighting, and Crisman, dubious, visited Maury and collected his own samples of the slag. Now, Crisman is a name familiar to those familiar with the JFK assassination lore. That's not my particular area of expertise, but I recognize the name and know that he's connected to that, and hopefully we can talk to Ken and others in the future about those interesting connections there. Nick, are you familiar with this case?
Yeah, I know this one pretty well, Miles. Yeah. It's Maury Island's a strange one, as you mentioned. It all sort of kicked off 60 years ago with this story about this guy Harold Dahl seeing this sort of fleet, I guess is the right term, of UFOs over Puget Sound in Tacoma. And reportedly one of the UFOs looked like it was malfunctioning and wobbling in the air and suddenly spewed out all this weird material that crashed down, as you said, in the bay and reportedly killed the family dog and injured Dahl's son and one or two other people. And reportedly the material was handed over to this guy, Fred Crisman, who, as you mentioned, was kind of an unusual character, seemed to have a lot of connections in the official world and a very shadowy and mysterious guy. And he got hold of some of the material, and then Ray Palmer at Fate magazine found out about the case and actually hired Kenneth Arnold to go out there and investigate the incident to see what would turn up. And even Arnold had some weird aircraft problems when he was out there, which could have ended in catastrophe. But basically, the short angle of the story is that the material evidence, the debris that was found at the harbour, was handed over by Crisman to two U.S. Air Force guys that had been flown in especially to take a look at the materials and fly it back to Wright Field, which is Wright-Patterson today. So they loaded the plane up, took off, and never made it. Their plane exploded on the way to their final destination, if you like, and the material evidence was reportedly never found at the scene. So we're left, like a lot of these cases, where, you know, was it all some weird hoax, as some people believe, that ended in tragedy, or, you know, was someone trying to deliberately sabotage even the two military guys from getting to a location because somebody else was trying to intervene? We just don't know, but it is a fact that the main player, Fred Crisman, who had the materials, did turn up in 63 relative to the Kennedy assassination. He was actually, claims were made that he was one of the three so-called hobos arrested rounded up is probably a better term, in Dealey Plaza just after Kennedy was shot. And he always denied this, and there's a lot of questions asked about it, but his name has turned up on a number of occasions with respect to, you know, his links with the intelligence community. And it even turns up in one of the leaked MJ-12 documents, which makes it clear, if the document's genuine, of course, that he was some sort of inside player. And I know a number of researchers have suggested the theory that maybe Crisman got hold of genuine materials from whatever these objects were and then used that as kind of leverage to work his way in to the intelligence community, you know, sort of blackmail them to say, unless you give me some, like, a prestigious position, I'm going to go public with this material. I know that various theories have been put forward to what these objects were. You know, you have the straightforward UFO theory. Another one that was put forward was that there was some sort of advanced prototype platform created by the military that was being test flown and that went off course. We just, you know, 60 years on, the fog of time, and everybody's dead now. It's sort of probably impossible to really get a definitive answer. But I mean, you mentioned Ken, and I think his book is probably the closest and the most sort of definitive look at the subject we're going to get, unless, you know, something really out of the ordinary does turn up one day.
Now, oh, there it is. Okay, I've been looking for this article. That's not the one. It didn't, in the last month or so, this guy who's been wandering the mountains where this plane supposedly crashed just found the aircraft, supposedly. And I think this is, secret UFO plane wreckage found in Cascades. I remember this happening, date on this. April 24th, 2007, Longview, Washington, the wreckage of a plane that went down, possibly on a secret government mission, has been discovered in the Cascade foothills almost 60 years later. Jim Green of Longview has been combing through the wreckage of the B-25 bomber, trying to uncover secrets that could be linked to the mysterious UFO program. Two of the four crew members were killed in the crash in August of 47. And newspapers reported the plane's crew members were flying disc investigators searching for UFOs and carrying a top-secret payload. I mean, the whole case is just drips of mystery, you know?
It's a very weird story.
One thing that occurred to me while we were kind of reviewing the story was, I wonder if anyone's ever done any diving at the site in Puget Sound.
You know, that's a good point. I don't actually know the answer to that question, but I mean, you know, given its location, it's not like, you know, in the middle of the Atlantic or somewhere where it'd be hard to get.
Yeah.
You know, you could conceivably just rent a boat and get a few experienced people out there and drop them down and, you know, spend the day combing the bottom of the waters. I don't know how deep it is, actually, but I mean, you know, I'm sure it's not to the point where it makes it impossible.
What struck me about the story was that, it's kind of amazing that the boat was not sunk.
Or caught fire.
It talks about pieces of sheet metal, and it says several tons of hot lava-like material.
That's one of the questions. I mean, there are, you know, outstanding points, excuse me, about this case that make some people think it's genuine, others think it's a hoax. One of the more interesting theories that was put forward was the possibility that it was actually an orchestrated official hoax designed to steer people away from the Roswell controversy that went wrong. And, you know, this was supposed to run and keep everybody out of the picture while, you know, whatever happened at Roswell was cleared up. I'm not sure if that really holds water, but it was certainly put forward anyway.
Well, I'm confused temporally speaking. I thought this incident happened, the alleged incident itself, the sighting and the contact, the close encounter, happened June 21st.
It did, but I mean, one of the questions, or one of the theories that was put forward, is that when Roswell happened, the events, whether it was a hoax or not, was sort of reboosted, if you like, or rebooted, sort of around early July to try and boost its profile and then sort of demystify it as a hoax and then say, well, you know, they're all hoaxes. But that apparently didn't happen because of Kenneth Arnold coming along and digging into it. And I mean, there are a lot of weird stories with Arnold. For example, how his hotel room in town was supposedly bugged, and one of the guys from the local newspaper apparently had a pretty much a word-for-word account of, you know, conversations held in his hotel room. So there was a genuine lot of strange things going on, which for a hoax, you know, doesn't really hold water.
Yeah. And, you know, really just the whole proximity in time of Maury Island, Roswell, and Kenneth Arnold.
Kenneth Arnold's and actually the timing, well, it seems like this whole window opened up, as they some say. A news article that caught my attention that definitely isn't paranormal that just came out today. From the National Security Archive, that's the gwu.edu website, CIA's Family Jewels. Agency violated charter for 25 years, wiretapped journalists and dissidents. And CIA announces declassification of 1970s skeletons file. Shades of celebrity secrets here. Archive posts Justice Department summary from 1975 with White House memcons on damage control. And So I haven't had the chance to read over all of this, but it does mention, I believe it mentions human experimentation.
Hmm.
25 years until revelations of illegal wiretapping, domestic surveillance, assassination plots, and human experimentation led to official investigations and reforms in the 1970s. So it mentions up to some 11,000 pages of the so-called CSER, POLO, and ESAU papers. Lots of interesting stuff that could be dug into, I'm sure, but that just caught my attention as something that just hit today.
Yeah, I'm going to have to take a look at that.
Well, that's a great resource, the National Security Archive.
Oh, it is? It's a good one?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. These guys are not to be confused with their NSA agency counterparts that share the acronym, but this is the website that is putting out some really amazing documentation at least every month. This is also one of the places you can find copies of the Operation Northwoods document that was publicized in James Bamford's book Pre-9/11, which has the plan that seems to mimic or mirror a lot of what happened related to 9/11 and subsequent years in a really weird manner that has made a lot of people speculate that there was something more to September 11th than we've been told. But without going into all that, I just wanted to bring up the National Security Archive, CIA's family jewel. So you talked about some things that you wanted to bring up on the show today for the roundup, Mr. Redfern. So what's first on the list?
Well, there's been kind of a resurgence, I guess, if that's the right word, in cryptozoology in the last few weeks. Not so much a resurgence, but certainly a lot of cases and information, even film footage coming forward that sort of really propelled the whole subject back into the public domain, not just in the crypto or 4chan communities, but, you know, at a national and international level even. And one, I'm sure you know about this, is this new footage that surfaced just recently of the Loch Ness Monster, filmed in England by a Mr. Holmes, no relation to Sherlock. And basically it shows, or what appears to show, some sort of lengthy physical living creature moving in the loch. And if you look at the film footage, at one point it almost does look like some sort of neck comes out the water, or at least rises slightly out of the waves. Now, precisely what it is, you know, we just don't know. For me, at least, it's intriguing footage, and I know that in keeping in touch with friends back in England, you know, particularly the English media always goes crazy when there's new material on the Loch Ness Monster. It actually made all of the national newspapers and has been a very high-profile story. I think what a lot of people perhaps don't realise about Loch Ness, you know, they say, well, England's a small island, and you know, how could some sort of large creature or a colony even, you know, hide out in a small loch in this equally small country? And what a lot of people perhaps don't appreciate is that Loch Ness is actually a huge body of water. It's 23 miles long, a mile wide, and nearly 1,000 feet deep. So it literally is a huge body of water. And not only that, the water of Loch Ness is actually pitch black because it contains so much peat that the peat has literally changed the water. It just looks like oil. You go down about 6 inches into Loch Ness and you cannot see a thing at all. So, you know, the idea that if this thing is a water-breathing animal and actually doesn't need to surface that often, you know, like a mammal would, then it actually isn't that strange that we perhaps wouldn't have the answers to whatever this thing really is. John Downs, a friend of mine back in England, who runs the British-based Centre for 4chan Zoology, which I run the US office of, John's actually literally right now in the north of England at a lake called Lake Windermere. And Lake Windermere is a large lake on just before the border of Scotland. And over the last few months, there have been reports of a similar type creature having been seen there. And John's made several trips up to the lake to basically scan the area, and even got divers involved to go out and, you know, sort of check out, see if anything can be found. And there are a number of intriguing photographs as well that have been taken there. John seems to be of the theory that as far as the Lake Windermere creatures or animals are concerned, he thinks they could be some sort of unrecognized type of, literally like a monstrous eel. I mean, we're not talking about sort of a 6 or 7 or even 10 or 15 foot eel, but, you know, sort of 25, 30 foot long, huge creature, which, you know, by definition would be monstrous.
Damn.
Now, one of the interesting things about this theory is that although you don't get many reports in this category at Loch Ness today, in the early part of the 20th century particularly, you got a lot of reports of people seeing the creature on land.
Crossing the road.
Yeah, and people driving the cars late at night, you know, they'd see this lumbering thing splash into the water, which, if like an eel, you know, we're talking about something that potentially could leave the water, that might explain some of these sightings. You know, and people, a lot of cryptozoologists, you know, stick to the theory that, well, it has to be some sort of dinosaur like a plesiosaur. I think it's perhaps a mistake on the part of the media that assumes that everybody who hunts monsters, for want of a better term, sticks to this particular theory. But when you look at it, a lot of people are quite open to the idea that it may just be something that's totally unidentified, not some sort of surviving relic from the era of the dinosaurs, but maybe just an unclassified species of creature that's become landlocked for thousands of years.
And aren't there are old reports of folks challenging critters in some of these smaller locks and what I guess over here we'd call stock ponds. And there's even woodcuts, I think, of you know, this classical, you know, lack of a better term, a knight.
The lightning worm, I think,
that's right.
Grows out of one of those legends.
Yeah, I mean, in Scotland, for example, there's numerous lakes and lochs, literally dozens and dozens of them, and a good percentage actually have monster legends, lake monster legends attached to them, one being Loch Morar, not too far from Loch Ness, and that has had a monster legend attached to it for centuries.
Morag?
Yeah, that's right, Morag, the creature's known as.
I nipped over to the bookshelf for just a second. Mm-hmm. What you said about reports of the creature being seen on shore triggered a memory. Are you familiar with the book The Great Orm of Loch Ness by F.W. Holliday? Holliday documents a number of the on-land sightings and draws what I think is probably the most interesting and probably the weirdest speculation about the identity of the monster, in that he posits an enormous invertebrate based on a fairly obscure but convincingly similar creature from the fossil record called the Tully Monster, which has actually shown up on the side of some U-Haul vans here in the United States. What you mentioned about Mr. Down's notion about the giant eel, I have to admit, that's, looking at the newest footage, that seems to be the most likely candidate.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, I don't dismiss the idea that it could be something more exotic. You know, I don't dismiss that at all. But I think there's enough evidence to suggest that that theory has a lot of merit to it. And again, you know, it doesn't dismiss the idea that there is really something genuinely monstrous in the loch. You know, if you're walking past Loch Ness late one night and a 30-foot long eel that's got a body 2 feet thick or something slithers past you, that is by definition a monster. So,
indeedy, and I'm just going to hope it doesn't have the habits of a moray.
and a lot of the accounts that Ted Holliday talked about and that in his other books, or that the people that had these close encounters with these things were genuinely repulsed by it reminded them of like entrails.
Yeah, you know, that's the interesting thing is that, I mean, a number of researchers, and this gets into really controversial areas, have suggested, you know, that all these lake monsters and so on, the reason we never catch them is because they're not actually physical creatures, that they're more paranormal in some way. And when you look at Loch Ness, there are actually a very substantial number of intriguing stories that, you know, if you believe that theory, that there's a weight of evidence behind it. For example, none other than Aleister Crowley's house on the shores of Loch Ness called Boleskin House, which was later owned by Jimmy Page, the guitarist from Led Zeppelin.
And
Crowley was involved in all sorts of ancient rites and archaic rituals in which he tried to, when he was living at Loch Ness, he tried to summon up demons and all sorts of weird creatures, and it had sort of like a negative backlash effect on him and people in the house, and created like an atmosphere of negativity, etc. And it was a fact that after this, in the immediate years afterwards, there was a resurgence of monster sightings. And you're quite right about a number of people have said how they've seen this thing, and rather than just be amazed by the fact that they've seen some weird creature, they've actually got this kind of feeling from it that it is in some way sinister or evil. Not in the sense that they're able to actually definitively explain why or how. Some people have said the movements of it were sort of unusual. It almost kind of wriggled and shook as it was moving, almost like vibrating at high speed. There are a number of reports where people have tried to photograph it only to find the cameras have jammed.
Yeah, and again, there's all these parallels to these other phenomena. Of course, Ted Holliday, F.W. Holliday, he was one that connected, again, UFO sightings and other strange phenomena, including his own weird pseudo Men in Black encounter that I think occurred actually near the spot where he eventually had a heart attack, I think.
But, yeah, that's right. I mean, when you dig into these subjects, whether it's, lake monster, sea serpents, Bigfoot, big cat sightings in England, the black dogs, owlman, mothman, all these creatures, it seems to be these specific categories that we never manage to catch them or get definitive proof. It always seems to elude us. And the big question is why is that? Is it because there's just, a small relic population of these things surviving, or is it because the nature of them is that they aren't, physical in the sense that we understand the term? But certainly Scotland and Ireland and the north of England have had lake monster legends for years. And as Craig mentioned, England itself is rife with tales of knights slaying dragons, which when you look into the cases deeper, a lot of them actually are described as coming out of the water and being more like giant worms than, literal fire-breathing dragons, like something out of a Godzilla movie or something like that.
Nick, do you know offhand where exactly St. George is supposed to have slain the dragon?
Well, that's another interesting thing. It's because if you look into the legends of St. George and the dragon, what you actually find is that there are probably 10 or 15 stories that parallel that of St. George and the dragon. So it's not so much, where did he slay the dragon or where didn't he? It's which of the stories was the original one that led to the later tales, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
There's a classic one. There's one called the Lambton Worm. Now, the Lambton Worm was this creature that was reportedly caught in a river, a guy out fishing one day centuries ago, caught this little creature, didn't know what to do with it, it looked strange, so he threw it down a well, and then, lo and behold, a few years later, this huge 30-foot-long writhing worm rises out of the well and causes havoc in the area. And it's subsequently slayed and killed by a guy who comes back from fighting in the Crusades, a knight. Nothing to do with St. George and the Dragon, but the story is so similar that, it has parallels, as do all these tales. So either, one is a parallel and a tale based on another, and if it is, I suspect that somewhere down the line, there probably was some sort of originating story, but there are a lot of tales of particularly from about the 1400s to the 1600s, and then they kind of die out, of people seeing weird, not massive, but sort of 10-foot long, 15-foot weird eel or worm-type creatures coming out of the ground or out of pools. And, I don't dispute the possibility that maybe there was some sort of surviving creature that people would see occasionally in those days and be more superstitious, felt it was something demonic even, or just monstrous, and these legends took hold.
Especially if it were destructive to life and property, as a lot of these legends seem to suggest.
Craig has brought up on previous shows the tales of both just large salamanders and monstrous salamanders, and what was the creature that you read the excerpt from the book about the native peoples moved into an area where there were these things that may have been crocodiles.
The Buru.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of my prized pieces in my library as I stumbled across the recent republication of The Hunt for the Buru.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also, it's definitely a very instructive book in thinking about, you think to yourself, well, gosh, that's right there. I can point to it on the map.
Mm-hmm.
Why aren't people going out and looking at it? And it's like, well, because it's, 10 miles as the crow flies and 50 miles of trudging up one hill, down another, up, down, and...
Yeah, but then we have crazy friends like Nick and his friends who get to go to all these great places.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, cryptozoology, joking aside, it's one of these subjects where the one way I know for certain we'll never get the answer is just, sort of sitting at home wondering if Bigfoot exists or lake monsters
right.
exist.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the only way to do it is actually to get out there in the field and delve into, whatever these things are and meet the locals and speak to the witnesses. I mean, if you take, for example, the Chupacabras in Puerto Rico, I've been on two expeditions to Puerto Rico in the last couple of years, one with John Downs and one with Paul Kimball, a friend of mine from Canada who's a filmmaker. And really, not until you get out there and you spend, as I've done, sort of like a month literally trekking around the rainforests and hanging out in the little villages in the bars and getting to know the locals. And, you gain their trust and, then they say, well, what are you doing on the island? Well, I'm looking for this weird vampire-like creature with bat wings and glowing eyes that, reportedly sucks blood from the animals. And, they say, oh, yeah, go to the next village and speak to so-and-so. And it's then you begin to appreciate the sheer scale of the mysteries and how they're sort of ingrained into society in these areas. And, you begin to uncover people who you speak to, people have seen these things. And literally, you can find inside a week, 10 days, maybe countless more material than you'd ever find on the internet just by speaking to people who don't even have a telephone, never mind an internet connection, and whose stories have never surfaced before. So I think, that's one of the important things is that I think to answer particularly the cryptozoological mysteries, we need to really stay on top of things in terms of getting out there and really, spending time in the woods or wherever.
Well, I'm really glad you're doing that, and I was overjoyed to get the chance to explore eastern Texas environs with you and Paul Devereaux on the ghost road out there.
Yeah.
Looking for ghost lights and Bigfoot or anything strange.
Yeah, the only problem I have doing that is in Texas is the heat. Coming from England where the sun doesn't shine, it's like...
Well, hey, man, you chose to live here, too,
Oh, that's true.
Yeah, and in Dallas, no less.
That's right, in Dallas, no less.
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I just, moving along, and there were some other things that you had mentioned wanting to talk about, Nick, including the continued strange goings-on in your old haunt with the Beast Watch seeks the British werewolf.
Yeah, this is a weird story that's been going on, well, collectively now for at least a year in terms of the werewolves, as you mentioned. This has all occurred at a place in England, a large area of forest in central England called Cannock Chase, and which ironically was literally about 3 miles from where I used to live. And even back then, it had this reputation of being, like as some people call these places, window areas that, seem to attract a whole range of weird activity in the same way that, in the 1960s with Point Pleasant, West Virginia, when you had the Mothman sightings, you also had a lot of Men in Black encounters and poltergeist activity and all sorts of weirdness. And so you have the same situation in the Cannock Chase Woods. And as I said, it's a very large forest. There are a lot of old earthworks and that are perceived as being possibly ancient prehistoric burial mounds in the area as well.
You mentioning hill forts.
Yeah, hill forts, yeah. One famous one called Castle Ring. And if you go to Castle Ring, they've actually got old displays of painted pictures, I should say, of how it used to be looking prehistoric times. I mean, I can remember even as, as a young child, sort of 10 or 11, stories used to surface of ghost encounters and, weird lights in the sky and all sorts of things going on there. But certainly in the last 12, 18 months, it seems, you know, almost literally as if a doorway's been opened to some other realm and just, you know, these things are just flying through. The Cannock Chase in the last 2 or 3 years, there have been a lot of huge amounts of reports of mystery big cats, or as they're known in England, ABCs, alien big cats. And Britain, as far as we know, although some people subscribe to this theory, has never been home to sort of a large species of indigenous cat. Some people do think, you know, there could possibly be one that's stayed hidden from society for thousands of years. I think that's stretching it a little bit, but, you know, it has been addressed seriously. But nevertheless, people see these big cats. But in the same location where the cats have been seen on the Cannock Chase, roughly from the mid-90s to 2003, 2004, you've got a lot of so-called Bigfoot-type encounters. But they've sort of given way in the last 18 months or so to reports of very large wolf-like animals and even werewolf-type creatures, and some that might are described almost as being a combination of the two. And this is where the most recent sightings that you just mentioned come into play. For example, there have been a lot of reports at a place on the chase called the German Cemetery. It's called the German Cemetery because in the First World War, a lot of German prisoners of war were held nearby, and they all died of influenza, and there was a big influenza outbreak, and so they buried them at this cemetery on the Cannock Chase. And that's where, perhaps appropriately, being a cemetery, you get a lot of weird activity. A lot of big cats, a lot of UFOs, Bigfoot reports, but these werewolf sightings in the last few weeks and months have sort of really gripped the entire area and the media in the area. A lot of the people reported seeing what looks like a huge wolf. I mean, almost like the size of like a small cow, but looking like a wolf, that has, when it's been seen by people, has actually kind of reared up onto its hind legs and backed away into the woods, which sounds bizarre until you realize that people like Linda Godfrey in the US, who's written a couple of books on werewolves, she's chronicled very similar tales in similar areas around cemeteries, around ancient burial mounds and hill forts.
The Beast of Bray Road? Is
that's right, yeah, exactly, the Beast of Bray Road. And so, you know, you have parallels here. And bear in mind also, you know, a lot of England hasn't really changed for centuries. And so all around the chase, you have these little old villages that, you know, maybe have 100 or 200 people, and families go back generations, and they still live in the little old cottages. And so you have a lot of superstitions that really have never died out, and as I said, it's really gripped the area in terms of, you know, superstition and imagination, and a lot of people are, you know, quite worried. I mean, I've written about this on my blog a number of times, and various people who live in the area have contacted me, and one guy actually said, you know, I actually walked through the woods on the way to work, should I, you know, go on a different route or something like that. So, you know, people are definitely worked up and uptight about it. Now,
what'd you tell him?
I said, oh, you'll be all right, I guess. But I haven't heard back from him, so maybe I was wrong. But yeah, I mean, you know, it is a weird area, and it is kind of spooky. You get out there, and, you know, England in certain places, still, as I said, is like it was a couple of centuries ago, and you get in the woods and it is like a trip back in time, you know, no cars and skyscrapers or anything like that, and you can well imagine how people's, I'm not saying imaginations in terms of mistaking things that they're seeing, mm-hmm. but why it is perceived as like a magical, strange area. Now, just in the last couple of days, there have been a number of developments, one being there's a group in the north of England called Beast Watch that chronicle sightings of, I guess, what you would call sort of more cryptozoological creatures in England, such as the Bigfoot and the big cats, and also out-of-place animals. For example, you get a lot of wallaby and kangaroo sightings in England, believe it or not, because there have been a number of established colonies in private zoos that where they escaped, and they've just bred over the decades in different parts of the country, and now and again, you know, you'll see one bounding across the road or something like that. And more often than not, you get people say they saw a giant rabbit or something, and then, you know, when they dig into it, they realize it was a wallaby or a kangaroo. So,
yeah.
So you get Beast Watch. They chronicle all these various reports, and they're planning some sort of expedition to stalk the area out and hang out there for a few nights and see what turns up. Now, quite literally today, a news story surfaced. I say new, it actually occurred last November, but it's newly surfaced. And this came from a woman who saw what sounds like a very, very weird, spectral, ghostly woman on the Cannock Chase in the same vicinity where a lot of these other encounters had occurred. And I've just posted that to my blog today. So it seems whatever's going on, it's very much ongoing. And one of the most intriguing reports that I found as it relates to these giant wolves and werewolf-type creatures was actually reported officially. And this occurred in July of last year when a number of people on a large stretch of what in England is called the motorway, called the M6, were driving to work at 6, 7 o'clock in the morning and reported seeing this huge, gigantic wolf-like creature chasing across the three lanes of the motorway at high speed. And everybody was unanimous that, you know, it wasn't a husky dog or anything like that. It was like a giant wolf. And that was pretty much really when the sightings began to kick off large scale. And I'm hoping that next time I'm over there, which won't be too far in the near future, I'll be able to get out there for a few nights and pitch a tent up and just, you know, tape recorders and camera and see if I can get any evidence.
I was noticing in the stuff about the Beast Watch that they're requesting funds to help out because they have to camp out and you have to pay to stay in the park, I guess, or the forest.
Well, that's if they know where you are.
All right.
I mean,
that sounds about on par with
monster hunting on a budget 101.
Well, you know, I mean,
tell them you're there.
The thing is, I mean, the Cannock Chase is huge. Okay. You know, it's not like some little country park. It's not fenced or anything like that. It's just a huge forest. Kind of imagine like a state park in the U.S. that might have a road or two going through it, but it's just a huge area of, you know, original woodland.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and I guess you don't really have forestry the likes of which we do over here.
Oh no, nothing quite the size of, you know, like the West Coast, Oregon and Washington State, nothing like that. But I mean, certainly of a size, a large size. So, it wouldn't surprise me that if there weren't genuine big cats in there, because there are stories of people who supposedly had them as exotic pets, and then when the government changed the law on keeping these things, supposedly they released them because they couldn't afford the new fees and didn't want them put to sleep, so they let them go.
There's actually been a little bit of controversy in that regard here in Texas, too. I know the Austin Zoo, for instance, had a number of its large cats were originally from private collections, and some of the laws on keeping, I think, big cats specifically were changed in Texas not more than a few years ago.
Right. No, I didn't know that, but that wouldn't surprise me. I mean, you get a lot of these stories, and now that, you know, that's kind of like a wholly acceptable explanation for the big cats in England, but, you know, when you're sort of delving into things like Bigfoot and werewolves, I mean, you know, if there was a Bigfoot living in England, people say, well, you know, he could hide on the Cannock Chase, but, you know, these things have been seen for centuries.
Right.
If there was one, you know, if these things are physically real in England, there would have to be a colony of them, at least. And the idea that Britain, which has a population of 60 million, is actually smaller than the state of Texas. That's Wales, England, and Scotland combined are actually smaller than Texas, yet the population is like 20% of the entire U.S. population.
Mm-hmm.
So if you imagine the 25% of the entire U.S. population transferred to Texas, and then we're expected to believe that an entire race of Bigfoot creatures could hide there. And also, you know, as I mentioned, you have the fact that a lot of the sightings do occur in England in the vicinity of ancient earthworks and a lot of stone circles as well. There's one in further up in the north of England called the Seven Sisters, an ancient stone circle, and that has been the site of a number of weird Bigfoot-type encounters. And, of course, the question is, if Bigfoot's a real physical animal, in England at least, why does it hang out at stone circles?
And I think one of the best arguments for Bigfoot being some kind of ultra-terrestrial creature, Chad Armitt in the North American Bio-Fortean Review drew an interesting parallel, and he was talking about black bears are, I not an endangered species in Florida, mm-hmm. but I think they're listed as threatened, mm-hmm. and they're not at all common.
Mm-hmm.
But every year, somewhere between 150 and 200 are killed mm-hmm. on Florida roads. And that's in one state, mm-hmm. you know, one fairly modest population of essentially large, occasionally bipedal mammals.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his corollary to this was, where are the Bigfoot?
Yeah, that's right. That's a very good point. You know, the idea that we never seem to get the hard evidence. You know, sometimes people, as I said earlier, report their cameras jam. Or, I mean, I know Rob Riggs, for example, who you know, Miles, he went on this expedition to the Big Thicket in East Texas. You know, Rob has done extensive research in the Big Thicket area of East Texas into these man-beast type encounters, which are very often associated with weird little balls of light zipping around the roads.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you know, that suggests that even if these things are physical, that they have sort of weird or extraordinary capabilities or abilities that, you know, take them far away from being just lumbering, hairy creatures, if you like. And just sort of on this particular angle as well, which is, again, kind of a breaking story, a friend of mine back in England named Neil Arnold, he's just had a new book published, which is a huge book, about 400 pages, called Monster, the A to Z, or the A to Z, as we call it in England, of zoo-form phenomena. Zoo-form phenomena being the specifically paranormal entities, if you like, that make up cryptozoology.
Okay.
And this is a really good book. I had a review copy come the other day, and I've put a review again on my crypto blog today. It's, as I said, it's a 400-page book, literally lists with anywhere from sort of a quarter of a page to two or three page entries on a whole range of hundreds of different weird animals. But, you know, there have been various books that have been written in kind that list, you know, cryptozoological creatures. But Neil's is the first one that just specifically focuses on the more paranormal animals.
That's great.
And this is a good book, and it has kind of like a 1 to 5 star listing of the cases that Neil thinks, you know, have merit, or which ones are just legends and tales, and which ones might have a basis in a physical reality. So it allows the reader to sort of break down, you know, what each case means. But, I mean, you have classic cases from all around the world in that book that parallel, you know, one thing that's reported in America in the 20th century was reported, say, in Russia in the 1600s. A lot of reports of winged creatures like the Mothman or the Owlman. You know, werewolves having been associated with water. Sightings of weird monkey-like creatures at bridges or crossroads.
Mm,
and
yeah.
Black dog sightings all across the world in specific locations like crossroads and ancient cemeteries.
We're looking at the review down here at this end, and I can tell just by looking at the listing, you've got Jenny Greenteeth and the Macabre Toronto Tunnel Monster. This is,
I wouldn't want to meet her on a dark night, Jenny Greenteeth. Or maybe that once or twice.
I think we went to the same party on different nights.
Yeah, possibly.
But I really like the cover of this book too, and it just sounds,
oh, yeah, that's
sounds
a good cover.
Fantastic. Definitely going to have to get a copy of that.
But Neil's forte, if you like, is that this has been his passion for years, and this book for him, I guess, has been like a labor of love, in the sense that, you know, it's sort of the definitive work based on his researches of literally just cataloging some monsters and creatures I'm sure, you know, even the most experienced cryptozoologists will never have heard of, you know, purely and simply because they are so obscure. And I think, you know, hopefully this will become sort of known as the definitive guide to the more esoteric and paranormal end of the cryptozoology field.
Awesome. We're getting close to the top of the hour. Do you want to, have you got any other news items real quick you want to get in before we go to some music and take a quick break?
Yeah, sure. I mean, one of the things that is sort of coming forward right now, and which is actually an ongoing thing, is the British Ministry of Defence releasing their UFO files. And you know, I mentioned this before, the fact that there's one particular arm of the British MOD that has taken a decision to release several thousand pages of material that has been formally classified into the public domain. And there are rumours of, you know, a lot more material, not so much being held back, but purely through, I think, bureaucracy reasons, is going to take time to surface. But some of this material apparently describes close encounters between pilots and radar operators tracking weird things flying over the English coast and the mainland. And I think when the Ministry of Defence finally get it all scanned and put on their website, which is what they're now doing, or working on doing, I should say, that it'll probably open a lot of people's eyes to some of the more intriguing reports that the government has received over the years. And, you know, certainly most of the reports, I think, are your classic light in the sky type. But the small percentage of military reports in particular, and some of the police reports, definitely seem, from what we know from some of the stories that have come out already, to defy explanation in conventional terms, at least. You know, precisely what it means in terms of where these things are from, I think that's still open to question. But, you know, I'm kind of encouraged that the Ministry of Defence are sort of following on from the French decision to release their files. And it seems, reading between the lines, that one of the main reasons for the MOD deciding to go public with at least some of this material is due to the fact that they realised, with the French doing a similar thing, that people would say, what's holding you back, or what's holding you back from doing the same? And so, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing this material surface into the public domain, because I think, as with, you know, whenever anything new surfaces in cryptozoology, it always brings new material forward. And, you know, a lot of people are always, or a lot of people in the subject, kind of loathe to work with the media. I find that, you know, if you can get them to treat you right, working with the media is a good thing, because they have the ability to really get stories out there and pull new witnesses in, or old witnesses who haven't spoken before about something they may know of. You know, I think you always have to be mindful of the ridicule factor that the mainstream media like to play on, which is unfortunate. But, you know, they can be a good resource and tool as far as, you know, profiling what you're up to and getting witnesses to come forward. So I'm hoping that when these new military files surface, maybe, you know, some old 80-year-old guy who was in the military in the 40s or 50s, you know, was a young chap at the time and was personally involved, may come forward and say, hey, you know, I remember that case, I was involved. But certainly we know that some of the reports, at least, appear to be radar visual cases where we have ground-based radar tracking of something weird in the sky, and a pilot actually saying, yeah, I can see it 4 miles in front of me. You know, those are the reports, I think, you know, the small percentage that defy explanation and that are still sort of really worth delving into and, you know, seeing what we can find.
What your comment about the media, didn't you write a post to UFO Updates about turning down some media people because you made some demands, and they were like, well, no, we can't guarantee any of that. So you're like, okay, well, fine, I'm not going to work with you. Was that you? No.
That wasn't me, but I mean, I have done that. I mean, one of the things that I always stress, you know, whenever people do TV work or newspaper work, is to get across important, credible data rather than just generalities. You know, I think it's when you're dealing with the media, if you can present to them, sort of, for example, with UFOs, a copy of a government file that was classified and where the witness is a military pilot, and this person is trained, you know, to know what goes on in the skies. I think if you can get that across in a 10-minute interview with the media or whoever, that does hold some weight. And, you know, it does make them think twice about just labeling you as a crank, because, you know, that, to me, that's just lazy journalism. It's just taking the easy option. And I think that, you know, if you can present something strong and credible, that's a good thing. I think the one problem with all TV shows or, you know, whatever the media is, they always have the editing stage, you know, where they can cut and chop you to pieces. I've experienced that before in the past many times. That's just one of the hazards, unfortunately.
And that's, you know, kind of the backside of the explosion of shows on anomalies. Generally, ghost phenomena, but you
great entertainment, but I find myself like the old story about the Chinese restaurant. An hour later, I want to watch another one.
That's true.
You know, and it's good in a way because it broadens the exposure of the topic, but I really wish they were citing sources a lot more heavily because, you compare even a chapter of Body Snatchers on the Desert to, two or three weeks of UFO programs. You're just getting a lot more solid information a lot more quickly through the printed word.
Well, I think, you touched on the important point, Craig, about when you said entertainment. You know, you can watch a lot of shows on some of the mainstream channels, and it's quite clear that, not for necessarily sinister reasons, but they have an agenda in place already, which is to knock the UFO angle down or the Bigfoot theory down or the Lake Monster theory down and come up towards the end with the scientific skeptic with letters after his name who's going to demolish it all. And because he's the scientific skeptic with the letters after his name, he's the one they go with. And it's almost as if, the investigation is sort of half-hearted and not a full proper one purely because they don't actually want people to come to the conclusion that this particular channel endorses the idea that Bigfoot exists. Mm-hmm. And that's the unfortunate thing, is that when it's related to unexplained mysteries, you very, very rarely get an unbiased approach. There's always, the UFO people say that, this was an alien incident, but we found someone who says, it was just a government experiment, which in some cases is true. But it's almost like there's no way the channel will allow itself to be linked with anything that's truly anomalous because it backfires or it impinges upon their credibility. And that's unfortunate. Why not just go out on a limb, make a show and say, hey, we looked into it. We interviewed the skeptic, but we actually believe the believers. You very rarely, if ever, see that.
Yeah.
You may see it on the cable channels, and to their credit, people who don't make money from it, but they put their own shows out on a little cable channel in this city or that city, very enthusiastic about what they do. It seems the mainstream ones with the money are the ones who are least likely to actually take a chance.
That's interesting. I have almost the opposite perception.
Well, that's good. It's good to debate.
Why don't we leave the debating till the other side of the hour and close out the first part of the program here. You're listening to Anomaly Radio here on,
you're listening to Precognitive Dissonance, the premier radio talk show on the Anomaly Phenomena scene on AnomalyRadio.com.
All right.
With your hosts,
Miles Lewis.
And Craig York.
All right.
And our special guest, Nick Redford.
We'll be back in just a minute after some music, and we'll be diving into Body Snatchers in the Desert and the horrific, the horrible truth at the heart of the Roswell story.
A fork, knife, spoon, and straw. Be there or be square.